Hey everybody, it's Team Blockchain Radio. We're doing the Digital Bytes podcast covering the newsletter from January 19th, 2022. I'm very thrilled with this year so far. I'm not thrilled with the amount of people that are dying around me in the music industry, but I am thrilled with how we're doing with the Digital Bytes show. We're going to cover this week's newsletter. I'm going to bring Johnny Fry on. Johnny, I don't know if you're a fan of my other shows, but I mean, Betty White. And then I had the dad, Bob Saget, passed away. And Bob now Saget. You hear about Meatloaf?
Meatloaf, I'm in mourning. I'm really sorry, but, you know, what a performer. What a just a true superstar. Just love Meatloaf. Bad Outta Hell. You know, Paradise by the Dashboard Light. The sum of the stuff that Jim Steinway and him wrote together was just incredible. So, yeah, real shame. Today it's what, the 21st of January, and we got notice that he passed away, his wife beside his bed, and just a real loss, and a fantastic superstar, and really changed music in many ways with his album. What was it, back in 1977, wasn't it, when Bad Outta Hell first
Bad
came
Outta
out?
Hell, right?
I think it's got the title for the longest number of weeks in the US charts as an album. Just phenomenal, a real performer.
Very dramatic too, right? I mean, Broadway, movies.
West End.
Right.
He was over here in London for a while. Saw him several times. Loved him. Good friend of mine. Nita Scott, who went to see him with her a couple of times. Had a lot of laughs. We love Meatloaf. Really just a great fun entertainer. He always went away feeling very hot and sweaty, and you lost your voice because you sang to all the words. But there you go. But here we are, 19th of January edition of Digital Bytes. Good to be back on the radio waves on cyber.fm. And, you know, I'm sure some of your clients, your listeners, you've got 4.6 million of them out there. So some of them will never heard of Meatloaf. And some of the old timers like you and I will, I'm sure, have a fond memory of many discos and parties where that was being belted out on the dance floor.
Yeah, in fact, I've learned recently from, we have DJs in London, and I didn't realize how much of an impact he made over on your side of the pond. So yeah, that's the great thing about radio. We can talk about music all we want, right?
Yeah. Okay. So this week we got a number of different articles, looking at sort of DAOs, got someone looking at sort of how next year could be sort of, you know, more decentralization. And, you know, are the financial markets, you know, are they a bit of an inflection point? And we're looking at that. And then after the break, we've got, our guest this week will be looking at sort of he's an interesting article. He's actually called the actual what he's looking at, Hiranda from a company called GMEX, High Fi for digital assets on road to hi-fi. So hi-fi music, it's all got a bit of a theme sort of tying in here. So we're joined after the break by Hiranda Misra from, he's the CEO of GMEX Markets. So we'll come on to him in a moment, but I'd like to kick off this week by talking about DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations. And without going through the article too much, what caught my eye was there's a company that is actually creating a DAO to try and buy Blockbuster. So another sort of media type theme here. And they're basically saying they want to try and, you know, raise the money, and they're looking to raise, I think it's $5 million to buy the Blockbuster video brand. And then they want to start creating more videos and films, because obviously the movie industry is really going gangbusters at the moment. And the reason that we sort of are bringing this to people's attention is that there's been a number of different comments in the press that decentralized autonomous organizations could potentially be the new venture capitalists or the new private equity firms of this world. And it got us thinking about what a DAO is. And once again, history teaches us so much, because actually a decentralized autonomous organization shares a lot in common with cooperatives. Or in this country, we used to have something called with profits funds that the insurance companies used. And essentially these were pooled vehicles where people put their money, and then the majority, if not all the profits, went to the people that had put the money into it. And that's really what a decentralized autonomous organization, a group of people get together and they say, we want to do something. I buy Blockbuster Video. If we're successful, we will own it and we will then commercialize it or sell it or whatever it is. But instead of having, if you like, a third party, another shareholder or managers or whatever, then the profits go to the decentralized autonomous organization. So it's an interesting way of having community ownership. And if you remember last week when we were talking to our rock and roll mate, Brian Coyne from Kazi Holdings, you know, again, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it was all about greed is good and him with the most toys wins and all that sort of stuff. But now we're very much seeing this community driven type structure. And a DAO is very, very much that, whereby a lot of people get together, pool their assets, and actually then can benefit from the fruits of their ideas and thoughts that they've created.
Yeah, we also brought up in the past about like Wyoming, you can register your LLC as a DAO. And yep. I guess that makes it a legal, decentralized type of entity, right?
Yeah, well, again, the concept is nothing new in terms of having a number of people having a common goal and aim. But you're quite right. Wyoming in the USA have got some, they're much more progressive in terms of their adoption of sort of the digital asset space. But, you know, essentially what we're doing here is it's this horrible expression, disintermediation. And what it means is we're taking out the middlemen. We're taking out the people that take their pound of flesh. We're taking out the people that very often don't do very much. And that means that, you know, you as the investors potentially will get far more profit because you don't need all these layers of different people and arrangers and brokers and middlemen. You're getting closer to the action. So you get a greater slice of the cake. And that's really what a decentralized autonomous organization. And it's being the reason you can do it is because you've got technology such as blockchain, whereby you set up smart contracts. So you say, if this happens, we want to do that. And if that happens, we want to do this. So that's where the automation part comes in from it. And it's decentralized because it's not reliant on a management structure or a board structure where someone like the CEO or the CFO or, you know, the managing director, someone doesn't make a decision. The community, you know, propose something and they vote and say, yep, that's what we want to do. And that's what happens. So it's much more inclusive, which again seems to be a very common trait, certainly in some of the digital assets that are being created at the moment.
Yeah, they have something called investment clubs. Like grandma belongs to an investment club.
Yeah.
And then you they put their money together, they buy whatever stock it is they're looking to buy. So just imagine like grandma joining a DAO now so they can save up for a tokenized Google stock.
Yeah, well, but you know, funny enough, we're not that far off that, because if you look at a company called Index Coop or Index Co-op, COOP, they've got $400 million under management. And they're relying on their 6,000 members to effectively vote on the way the money is employed and managed. So rather than employing, you know, expensive fund managers like I used to do when I was running a mutual fund company, we relied on one or two fund managers to make those decisions. They're saying, no, we're going to rely on the crowd. We're going to rely on our members to decide where the money is actually being invested. And you can go and buy these index coupe funds on places like Coinbase. And then we list in this week's Digital Bytes, there's sort of five different funds that Index Coop actually have available. So this isn't something just for Blockbuster in the sort of media industry. We've already got tangible examples. You know, $400 million is not too bad, is it? That they're managing on a sort of on a decentralized autonomous basis.
And I guess that's where they're going in 2022 then. It's going to be the year of further decentralization.
Well, and that's very much, we had a talking to the CEO of a company called Checked, and what they specialize in is self-sovereign identity. And they basically believe, and I suppose they would do, self-sovereign identity is going to go mainstream. And this is, you know what it's like, James, it's a pain in the neck when you want to change your bank account, change your utility, you know, or you've lost your passport or driving license. Trying to prove who you are is actually a real pain. And what they're, you know, the whole idea behind self-sovereign identity is that you have your identity and you share that with those that you want to share it with or the relevant bits. So here in the UK, if you want to go and buy a beer, you've got to prove you're over 18. You know, it's, and people are walking around with their sort of driving license or their passport. You know, and, you know, if you want to go and buy a packet of cigarettes, you've got to prove that you're over, I think it's over 16. Well, if you've got, just prove, look, here you go, I can prove I'm 20. You know, in your country, I know it's even worse. You know, I've been in California in particular, where my sister lives. And, you know, if you look like you're under 30, they want to see ID.
Because I was gonna
really restrictive.
Drinking at 18 over there, I got to move. It was right when I turned 18 in college. Right when I turned 18, they changed the law to 21.
Yeah, but you can drive when you're 15 or something crazy in America.
They'll give you a permit. Some states are 14. I think it's the minimum.
But my point is that you have to prove that you're 14 or 18 or 21 or whatever it is. But you don't have to prove all your other information. You don't have to give all your other details. They don't care where you live. They don't care what your bank account is. They just want to have, in that particular case, your age. So that's very much self-sovereign identity, is you taking back control of your identity and then being able to sort of share that in a very secure way. And that's something I think we're going to see a lot more of sort of going forward. The other thing, just quickly, because I'm mindful of time as we're coming up to the break, but the other article that we talked about, which I really want to sort of bring your attention to, was the sort of the global fintech sector. And according to a company called Allied Research, they reckon the global fintech sector in 2020 was about 110 billion, but that was going to grow to be worth just under 600 billion in 10 years. So that's a compound growth rate of over 20%. And it's interesting to see the number of different ways that, if you like, traditional finance is beginning to be changed and altered. And some of the things, you know, we've just touched on decentral autonomous organizations, a relatively new term, but the basic concept goes right back and predates many of the financial markets and the mutual fund industry that we know today. You know, is there were things much before mutual funds. As I say, in the UK, we had these things called with profits funds. And so what we're seeing is a lot of money being plowed into, if you like, the financial tech market. And that's actually going to make the thing, again, we've talked about this, but the 1.7 billion people who are outside the banking system. Now, you imagine what it's like at the moment, you know, in countries, you know, what's happening in Tonga. It's just a nightmare, you know, that the whole economy is being brought to its knees. But as soon as they get, you know, some sort of mobile phone system fired back up, then all of their sort of financial services pretty much could be online on a mobile. You haven't got to worry about going to physical buildings. You haven't got to worry about cash being moved around and all the rest of it. And it's, we've seen this time and time again, you know, in lots of parts of Africa, whereby there's, you know, millions, hundreds of millions of people unbanked. And yet you, by having digitally banking and having the ability to be able to move money with digital currencies, means that they can now be included, which is the first time for a long, long time. And that's why we're seeing this whole initiative of something called open banking, which sounds really boring, really dull, but actually the governments are trying to encourage the ability for people to be able to move banks very much, much easier and change banks and get better deals, borrow money cheaper, invest money and get a better return. So it's an important part. It sounds dull, but it's really important. It's going to affect many, many of our listeners, both in the so-called developed markets in the West, but also, you know, the faster growing, exciting, emerging and developing countries around the world, where I know, you know, Cyber.fm have a lot of people that listen to our shows.
You know, what's interesting also is that the 24/7 concept, like even when you and I, you know, I'll buy Ethereum or something, you know, for the day and see how it's going to do. You know that you're going to wake up in the morning to what could very well be a absolute, you know, disturbance, or you could wake up rich, right? Because while you're sleeping, those markets are continuing to go. And I can tell you, in the U.S., we are not used to that. We still use terms like, when does the market open? In which case, we're talking about basically a trading view chart resetting, right? It's 7 p.m. Eastern time is midnight over by you.
Yep.
We call it a market open, but it's really never stopped.
Well, and that's the whole thing about, you know, here we are on a Friday evening. It's about 4 o'clock here in London. So 11 o'clock on the East Coast of America. So we've got, so what time do your market shut? Another 8 hours? 9 hours?
No, well, we have after hours trading, of course. If you count that, then I would say 7 hours, yeah.
7 hours. So after that, you know, we've got all the potential problems around the world with, you know, problems in Ukraine, for example. Well, let's say something crazy happens tomorrow, it's a Saturday. Well, the stock markets are shut on Saturday. They don't open until early morning Tokyo time on Sunday. So, which is Sunday in Europe. And it's, you know, it's middle of the night in America. So if you want to do something, you think, oh, the markets are collapsed, I want to buy or I want to get out, forget it. It's very, very difficult. Whereas with digital currencies, the whole thing is these things trade 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and therefore gives the ability to move in and out. And, get, you know, rather than you being told when you can trade, you decide when you want to trade. And that, and surely being given the choice has got to be a good thing. Bit of a nightmare if you're managing money, because you can't be managing money 24/7. So you've either got to have a team of people or you're going to rely increasingly on algorithms and computers to take over the slack potentially.
Oh, I could tell you personally, it's a lot of fun.
Right. OK, James, I'm mindful we've got our guests waiting. So as I say, I'm going to be talking to Haranda from GMEX Group just after the break. And if anyone wants to get a copy of this week's Digital Bytes or receive it once a week by email, then all they've got to do is just contact you at cyber.fm or myself, Johnny Fry, JONNYFRY. We're both on LinkedIn and happily we'll send you a copy. Otherwise, listen in to next week's show because we air this show every week together, James.
Yeah, that's right. And like you said, in a minute or two, we're going to bring on your guests from GMEX and hopefully we get to have a good conversation about hi-fi.
Hi-fi for digital assets. Yeah. Brilliant. We'll speak to you after the break. Thanks, James.
All righty.
This is real-time music playing, cryptocurrency paying, free money radio, cyber.fm, cyber.fm.
Hey, as promised, we're back and we're talking about the Digital Bytes podcast from earlier. You know, we talked about Meatloaf because it's that particular week. But the newsletter went out, and as always, Johnny brings a friend. I feel like, I don't know if you guys have Prices Right or anything with Don Pardo on television back when I was growing up in America anyway, and I feel like I'm getting every week. It's like, so Johnny, who have you brought over?
Well, it's this week, delighted. We've got Haranda Misra, and I'm delighted I mentioned the name Haranda, not Miranda, because Haranda, you said sometimes you're called Miranda, not Haranda, until you start speaking, or have I totally confused everyone already?
Yeah, that's right. You know, try and ascertain whether I'm male or female, but certainly very male.
good.
And strong alpha male.
well, welcome to the show. And as we were saying, a very tenuous link with obviously the sad passing away of, Meatloaf, just recently. And you've written an article, High Five for the Digital Assets Road to Hi-Fi. But hi-fi has nothing to do with music in this sense. It's presumably to do with sort of high finance. Good. Okay. But before we just get into the article, love for the listeners' point of view, because we've got a real selection of listeners in well over 140 odd countries that Cyber.fm broadcast to. Be great just to get a bit of background on yourself and how you got involved in sort of, you know, digital assets and the current role of CEO of GMEX Group.
Yeah, absolutely. So my career has kind of spanned about 25 years in electronic trading and then exchanges. Initially started out at Reuters, which is now kind of part of that Refinitiv business under London Stock Exchange. Then moved to an agency brokerage that was headquartered in New York called Instanet that Reuters owned before it spun out. And then from there incubated a platform called Chi-X, which took on the European exchanges and became about 30% market share of pan-European equities. And then with the exit from that, it's going to be our 10-year anniversary in May, but founded GMEX with another partner. And then we effectively started to work with exchanges and market infrastructure and then got into digital assets where we saw an opportunity in the US with a CFTC regulated venue, CFTC being the futures and options regulator in the US. And, got into that about 5 years ago and then realized there was a broader opportunity where, the Neo guys were going completely digital And then you had traditional finance on the one hand, and really the market need was to be hybrid, or hybrid finance, or hi-fi, as we call it.
Okay, so to paraphrase that, you've got a lot of in-depth experience of traditional trading of equities and derivatives, and sort of some, let's say, more esoteric, complex stuff that the average lady and man on the street, you know, is heard of, but they're not involved with. But you're bringing that experience and knowledge, and you can see there's an opportunity, what, in the digital asset field. And here we're not just talking about crypto, we're talking about presumably the digitization of equities and bonds and things like that. And you can see there's some crossover ground, there's some interesting ways the two sectors can kind of work together. Is that a fair comment?
I just want to add in there real quick, Hiranda, you followed my exact career path. That's exactly my exact, I could speak better. I went from Bloomberg to Merrill to Bank of America, all for financial, you know, fintech and connecting the exchanges using fixed protocol. I mean, I worked with Instanet. You and I probably know each other.
Yeah, no, that's right. It's a small world, and the kind of island Instanet alumni, or Datech as it was before then, you know, right. They propagated kind of all over the place, actually. You know, the likes of Tal Cohen, who's at NASDAQ now, and a number of others. So, yeah, I mean, we've probably got a lot of mutual friends. Yeah.
Because when were you in New York, Hiranda? Because James was on Bull Street for a while.
Yeah, so our offices were in Times Square, and although, you know, I was kind of based out the London office, but I was there regularly, kind of every other month, and spending quite a bit of time in between New York and then what we were doing in London as well. You know, the mothership was always driving certain things, as we called it, but it was great. It was very dynamic, can-do attitude. You either sank or swam, and that was a great thing about kind of Instanet as a company. You know, now part of Nomura, the Japanese investment bank, of course. Yep.
Oh, small word, see, James. Introduce another old mucker of yours. You're probably down some dodgy bar playing.
Wait, no,
playing
it really is like it's a small world, and now the whole crypto and I like this idea of hybrid finance. It's probably going to catch me using it. The gigantic world becomes so small immediately. It's the same people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just going back to Johnny's question, I mean, a lot of the time, I mean, the crypto markets came about, and mostly, I mean, even today, they're unregulated. But at the same time, you know, we speak about kind of mom and pop, but also institutional investors who want to get into this space. You know, they want the jargon simplified. They want ease of access, but they also, you know, want to have trust in the system. So it's like anything, you know, you have trust in the system in terms of what you're buying, the security elements, other aspects. And therefore, you know, again, regulation shouldn't stifle innovation, but we certainly need it. You know, the decentralized purists may talk about it not being needed, and the fact that, you know, a smart contract can affect everything needed that, let's say, a central authority could. Really, there's a middle ground here where, you know, we need to become more innovative with centralized finance. But at the same time, you know, things are great when they're not going wrong. But, you know, how do you protect mom and pop and institutional investors when things do go wrong? And that's where kind of hybrid finance comes in, really.
So can you explain a little bit about what you mean by hybrid finance? Because obviously, certainly the regular listeners will be familiar with DeFi, because we've spoken about DeFi, and we write about that a lot in Digital Bytes. But how do you define hi-fi then? Is that the next iteration of if we've gone from C5, centralized finance, to decentralized finance, and now we're talking about potentially high finance? Is that the sort of progression path?
Yeah, I mean, you know, CeFi, as you put it, centralized finance, or TradFi, as some call it, traditional finance. Yeah. I mean, obviously, we've all been familiar with that. Decentralized finance, very, very interesting. I mean, sometimes I kind of laugh because, you know, new jargon is created. And James, you'll know this from Bloomberg. I mean, in Reuters, I mean, when I joined, it was April Fool's Day, 1996, I was given a booklet and it was a dictionary of acronyms, you know, that Reuters used internally. And you almost had to learn that like a second language, really, because, you know, everyone spoke about, you know, RIC codes, which were their identifier and things like that. And, you know, there are complete sentences of acronyms. So sometimes, you know, when people talk about kind of decentralized finance. I mean, to me, yes, it's really innovative use of technology, but some of the essential elements remain the same, because there's only so many ways you can, you know, reinvent finance. So if you look at, you know, you probably discussed it on previous programs, yield farming from a DeFi perspective, it's a form of repo, you know, as far as finance is concerned. And there's plenty of other things. So, you know, when we look at that, you know, you've got that world that typically is relatively unregulated, centralized finance that's very regulated with, you know, securities, bonds, and some of the asset classes you speak about, Johnny. But really, you know, everyone speaks about blockchain as a single construct, but there are multiple blockchains, whether it's proof of stake ones, you know,
exactly. Yep.
Everything is entirely fragmented. I mean, there's an atomic problem in many ways as well with interoperability across blockchains, even though, you know, there's some kind of layer two protocols trying. But at the same time, you know, you've got centralized finance that through standards interconnected. And, you know, we can all have views on some of those networks, whether it's Swift or whether it's CLS or FX. But at the same time, you've now got very, very fragmented decentralized finance. With you know, new blockchain coming up, you know, every week it seems. So the real need there is, well, how do we bridge that gap? Because most people, whether it's mom and pop on the street or whether it's institutions, they're off chain as well, and many of them, you know, even if they want to be on chain, might be on one chain, but they don't want to be on 10 different chains, but yet still want exposure to those asset classes. So, you know, hybrid finance is about bridging that gap between, you know, what I call the neo side and the decentralized side, and then the traditional side, and making sure that that construct is kind of horses for courses. You know, if you want to connect using, you know, mobile app or some kind of application program interface, great, right? You don't have to be on a blockchain to then avail yourself of access to digital assets. True. But, you know, at the other on the other hand, if you're really, really tech savvy and you're into kind of decentralization, then it doesn't act as a restriction either. So that's kind of hybrid finance with regulation, but in a sense that promotes innovation at the core of it.
But I'm sure you've probably seen in the papers in the last week, 10 days, you've got Jamie Dimon talking about JP Morgan and they're committing to spend an incredible $12 billion on fintech, on technology in the financial sector. And we're seeing huge amounts of money in, you know, particularly in the US, and the UK is kind of, you know, got a commanding position here in Europe. So we're seeing a lot of money being pumped into this sector. And do we really need it, though? Do we need this sort of hi-fi, DeFi, Wi-Fi? Oh, sorry, Wi-Fi, something different. But, you know, or is it just the sort of the techies, the geeks have taken control of the factory, and, you know, we just need to get back on a box and go back to, you know, a quill and a feather pen and get the bowl hats out, because it worked then. Why do we need to change it all?
Actually, it's a really good question. I mean, ultimately, it's got to be about choice, whether it's consumer choice or whether it's the choice that kind of businesses and corporations make. So, for example, you know, when you talk about, you know, a quill and paper, I mean, you know, ultimately, then, you know, we saw email come along, and after that, we saw instant messaging come along as well. But it doesn't mean that, you know, the postman's been rendered obsolete. You know, we still have post, we still have paper, yet, you know, we have emails, we have instant messaging as well. And so, you know, again, you know, there's centralized systems, but some banking platforms are still running on, you know, old school kind of IBM mainframes and COBOL code as well, even though those programmers are steadily becoming less and less as they retire. So really it's about, yeah, I mean, technology can act as an enabler. I mean, we've been seeing that, you know, over the dawn of time, you know, whether it was then the Industrial Revolution and now, you know, it's a fourth Industrial Revolution. But ultimately, one, we shouldn't be using technology for technology's sake. You're absolutely right. So, you know, many a time I've seen constructs where people say, oh, yeah, but, you know, let's say an illiquid corporate bond, you know, there's no magic wand. You put that on a blockchain, it's not going to become liquid all of a sudden. So there's got to be a fundamental change in the way that we do things using technology rather than technology for technology's sake. I'm a big advocate of technology affecting change and us using it and making our lives better. So you're absolutely right. You know, there's a middle ground here.
Okay. And how does how it's a flipping tricky job for the regulators, isn't it? Because not only are they trying to catch the bad lads and bad girls who are trying to do nefarious activities, which we're always going to get, and they're always trying to, you know, they get accused of sort of shutting the stable door after the horse is bolted. But they've also got to understand some of this technology in order to be able to regulate it. So you can understand why they're a little bit reluctant to embrace some of these changes sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, that regulation was designed in an era before this existed. In fact, you know, even pre-cloud computing. And so now the biggest challenge for regulators, especially those in jurisdictions that have mature regulations, you know, like Mr. Gensler, the SEC has been very vocal about this. It's about, okay, great, we've got existing regulations, but how do we affect policy and regulatory change factoring in these asset classes? And the way that some of those technologies are being harnessed in this regard. And it's not regulating the technology, it's regulating the activities. And that's an important point. You know, we had the same debate, you know, when I was at Instanet and algorithmic trading came in, you know, regulate the algos. But actually, you know, one of the misnomers about decentralized finance is, you know, everyone speaks about, well, actually it's decentralized, but ultimately, you know, what the regulator's site is, well, there's some form of control along the chain, whether it's some form of trust, whether it's developers programming the smart contracts. Ultimately, there is some form of central authority. Now, some on the decentralized side have you believe that that there isn't, but they'd cite some of the disadvantages or perceived disadvantages of big tech and saying, you know, when everything's kind of decentralized and you know, we're all kind of interacting in the metaverse, everything's going to be fine. But ultimately, you know, you've got to read between the lines and look behind things, and there's some extreme wealth being created on the digital asset side. Yep. Whether that's set up as a trust, whether that's through a token, or whether that's an organization, right? So we've got to cut through the vested interest. And as for regulators, I think, you know, some of the newer regimes which have had no legacy, like the FSRA at Abu Dhabi Global Market, they found it easier to put in place regulations. Others, if you look at the UK, you look at the European regulations, you look at the US, certainly it'll take a few years before those things come in. But I certainly think they will come in, and those organizations which adapt to them will be able to prosper, assuming we get the balance of regulation right.
Okay, the other thing which does strike me, though, is that, you know, we're increasingly living in this digitized environment. Do the national boundaries, are they becoming less and less significant? You know, in the breath of, you know, your last sentence there, you've mentioned three different regulatory jurisdictions. And if I want to go and buy Tesla shares, you know, potentially, do I really care whether I'm dealing with an exchange in Dubai, you know, in Paris or in New York? Do I really care? As long as I get my Tesla shares, surely I don't care. I just want to get the best price and at the fastest possible rate, surely.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question in the, you know, you don't care and, you know, you want to use your app, and then you want to have those shares reflected in your app alongside everything else. And really, we're going to see increasingly that happen. But at the back end, you know, what most people don't realize, and Facebook, as it was called at the time, you know, with DM, their stablecoin, realized this. I mean, there's no such thing as an international stablecoin. There's no such thing as an international bank or exchange. Yeah. The hardest part of all of this is you've got to get regulated in the different jurisdictions that you operate in, or through partnership, you know, whether it's promotions and marketing and things like that. And we've seen some of the decentralized or kind of centralized unregulated exchanges in recent times fall foul of you know, promoting securities when they shouldn't have done and so forth as well. And ultimately, whether you like it or not, you've got to join the dots. And that's not an easy thing to do, but therein lies the opportunity, because as far as mom and pop are concerned, you know, you want that app, whether it's a D app or whether it's any other kind of app, and you want to seamlessly be able to have in your portfolio, whether it's digital assets or whether it's Tesla shares or whether it's any other share from any other jurisdiction. And you've seen opportunity there with fintech firms emerging, a bit like they did in payments, that, that eradicate those barriers of entry through aggregation plays, for sure.
So that's interesting. So just, I'm mindful of time, but that's interesting. So as we've seen with payments, i.e. we've seen someone like PayPal, which is now nearly twice the size of Citibank. So we've seen a colossal being created in payments. You think potentially with the likes of sort of HiFi, we could maybe see an exchange or a platform that could be doing similar for sort of other assets, whether that be equities or bonds, that's effectively a fintech type business like PayPal was, and actually disrupt exchange and platforms potentially then.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we and what I do in my line of work, we're dealing with exchanges all the time, whether it's you know, neo ones or existing kind of traditional ones, and many of those there's one such one I'm interacting with at the moment, and their view is actually if we take a 10-year view from now, there'll be very few what you call kind of national exchanges left, because larger global ones are buying up exchanges across jurisdictions and creating that aggregation that way. There's also increased competition from the kind of fintech-driven digital exchanges as well. So actually, that in many ways is a good thing, because it's allowing some of those to reinvent themselves. But unless you kind of internationalize your offering, whilst at the same time, dealing with your kind of traditional domestic investors, it becomes very hard, because there's no real economies of scale, and the larger opportunity is on a global basis, but selectively. So we're beginning to see positioning emerge. It's still quite early as far as some traditional exchanges are concerned. But if we have this discussion 12 months from now, many more will have kind of raised their head above the parapet in terms of plays in this space.
Yeah, and there's a lot. If some of the conversations we've had in Europe and certainly here in the UK, there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes. So I think you're absolutely right. In the next 12, 18 months, a lot of what we're talking about now is to some extent hypothetical, people might be thinking, but actually it's a bit like a duck or a swan going across the lake. There's a lot of paddling going on beneath the surface, so it'd be interesting to see where that takes us. Rinda, that's fascinating. As you can gather, I could sit and talk to you all day about this sort of thing, because it's the sort of stuff we write about and are interested in Digital Bytes. But James, before we close out this week's show, is anything in particular that strikes your chord apart from a fellow chap working on Wall Street like you did for a while?
Right, I think I jumped in early on this one. Right, I took over for a moment.
But, no,
you know what drives me nuts? I'm just going to add an opinion, my soapbox moment. What the hell do I have to do to get a cancel replace on an order management system in crypto? Did you notice that? It's the dumbest thing in the world, but since you're in my industry, you probably know what I'm talking about. Why do I have to cancel an order and create a new one just to buy some Ethereum?
Yeah.
Have you noticed that? Am I the only one that detailed about my orders?
And actually, that's going to change, and is changing as well, because it's because of the way that these assets are handled, and then the way deposits and withdrawals work in them. But as we move forward, we're seeing some initiatives where the assets sit there, they're made available to the order management system or the venue, and then effectively those cancel replaces become a lot easier. So I think that pain point is steadily being removed now, but hasn't got to the masses yet.
And is good till cancel order. I feel like you're talking about algorithms, and I mean, not iceberg, right? I'm just asking for good to cancel to eventually clear themselves out. There's exchanges with orders out there that the traders have long moved on. They may have passed away. There could be a trader out there who's 97 years old right now. He's gone. His order will never expire. And that puts crypto into dead wallets.
Certainly does.
I mean, I might be dating myself. Maybe I'm old school, but cancel replace just saved me that millisecond. And maybe once a month. I think a good to cancel order really is only 30 days, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's bad. And then it can be reinserted as well. Yeah,
we need to apply that to the crypto world. There's my soapbox.
Oh, well, something else to put on the wish list by the sound of things, Surrender.
Here, here, and coming to an order management system near you soon, I would say.
Brilliant. Well, look, Haranda, thank you very much. Be great to get you back on. Sounds like we've got to make a note for the diary to get you on in 12 months' time, get an update on what's happened. You know, do we really give a high five to Hi-Fi?
Yeah, why not? It'd be my pleasure to look back 12 months and then see where we are.
Brilliant. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. Thanks for your article. If anyone would like any more information or get hold of you, is the best way through LinkedIn or have you got an email? How would people get hold of you?
Yeah, very active on LinkedIn. And then, you know, effectively, it's a good way of contacting me as well. So, you know, that way. And I've got my Twitter handle as well.
Okay, so that's Haranda Misra, which is HIRANDER, and then your surname MISRA.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for the article. Thanks for coming on to the show. And we will make a note to get you back and hold your feet to the coals, as they say, early in 2023. So, James, another show, another week. We're getting to almost the end of the month. Where's that month gone?
I don't know, but listen, people got to stop dying, all right? I'm not prepared to do a Rolling Stones dedication yet.
No, likewise. Well, you got a big show later this week, haven't you? A tribute for Meatloaf.
Tuesday, my show will have a tribute to Meatloaf, and we already did one tribute. My guy Ricky out by you in London, he did an amazing celebration of life of Meatloaf, which... mine might not hold a candle to, but I'm going to give it a shot. Yeah, Tuesday.
Good. Okay. All right. Well, thanks again, James. We'll be back on the air next week with another edition of the Digital Bite Show. If anyone wants to get a copy of the weekly newsletter, then either contact James at cyber.fm, or he's on LinkedIn, or myself, Johnny Fry, JONNYFRY. And we'll be back on the air next week. Thank you.
All right. See you then.